Good evening, planet Earth. Good evening to the strugglers out there making ends meet, connecting the pocketbook to reality and trying to buy that pizza paradise in the sky. Good evening. Good evening to the pirates fighting off the coast of California. The battle's been ongoing for over 17 years. The pirates are running angry. Their blood is running hot. Good evening. Good evening to those mountain travelers climbing hills, rappelling down El Capitan, La Capito. Capito Jones is coming for you, baby, and he's wearing spice leather underwear. It is Saturday, November the 23rd, 2024. It is about 8:17 p.m. That's p.m., baby, here on the Olympic Peninsula. Things are just starting to get exciting downtown. You can hear that electronic music coming from the what's happening here in Port Angeles. Crazy. People dancing the streets with glow sticks, singing songs, sure. Or maybe it's just depressing. Who knows? I'm going to read an article from the public broadcasting system, SoCal.org. The headline is "The Troubling History of Sambo's Pancake House." This was written by Hadley Mears and published on April 26, 2017, pre-Boblimp.doc. I read on. Here's a quote from the Los Angeles Times, 1977. "No black was ever referred to as Sambo ever thought he was being complimented for his cleverness." Here's a quote from the Human Rights Commission of Rhode Island, 1981. "The use of the name Sambos had the effect of notifying black persons that they were unwelcome at Sambo's restaurants because of their race." In 1957, two white men from Southern California were brainstorming a name for their new restaurant. Sam Battistoni, yeah, he sounds like, what they call that? Witness protection? Sam Battistoni Sr. was a short, compact, and determined-looking man from Jersey with a sketchy background, just kidding, who had run a diner in downtown Santa Barbara for two decades. Newell Bonnet was a 34-year-old equipment salesman whose father had been the mayor of Santa Barbara. They wanted a name that was catchy and that would be familiar to the working and middle-class families they hoped to cater to. Combining Battistoni's first name with the first two letters of Bonnet's last name, they christened their new establishment Sambo's. The first Sambo's Pancake House opened on June 17, 1957 on beachfront Cabrillo Boulevard in downtown Santa Barbara. True to their rather clunky slogan, "What this country needs is a good 10-cent cup of coffee." Yeah, I mean, I kind of agree, but Starbucks ain't gonna allow that. The restaurant offered bottomless, inexpensive cups of joe. A full breakfast was only $1.25, holy fuck. Sambo's soon began attracting a large number of customers, particularly at breakfast. From the beginning, Battistoni and Bonnet worked hard to foster a familial feeling at Sambo's from the clientele to the employees. According to Charles Bernstein, author of Sambo's Only a Fraction of the Action, Sambo's initial summer days in 1957 were especially exciting. Early each morning, Sam Sr., with his sleeves rolled up, would be busy cooking at one grill, while his 17-year-old just-graduated son was cooking at the other one. and his wife was serving breakfast to whatever customers happened to arrive. Oh, we know what that means, Sam. The family and Bonnet were counting on an array of 21 different pancakes and a few other choice offerings to keep the 45 counter and booth seats reasonably full. The good vibes also extended between the partners, Sam, with Bonnet later recalling, "Next to my marriage, my association with Sam Battistoni Sr. was one of the most pleasurable and gratifying associations that I have ever experienced." Wow. That sounds like a line Frank Sinatra uttered in The Manchurian Candidate. The men prided themselves on the warm atmosphere and decoration at their flagship restaurant. Its design was bright and cheerful. There were tantalizing views of the ocean, and the piped-in music was soothing and soft. However, no matter how welcoming the atmosphere, there was a large portion of the population who would never feel at home at that restaurant. For on the walls were seven paintings of the story of Little Black Sambo. Not to mention the name Sambo's itself, unintentionally or not, signaled to people of color that they were not welcome at the restaurant. Yeah. By 1957, the name Sambo already had a long and controversial history, since as far back as the 1500s, the name had been used to denote a black man. By the 19th century, Sambo had become an archetypal, degrading character in literature and minstrel shows. Sambo, the typical plantation slave, was docile but irresponsible, loyal but lazy, humble but chronically given to lying and stealing, historian Stanley Elkins wrote. His behavior was full of infantile silliness, and his talk inflated with childish exaggeration. Education specialist Jesse Bertha explained that the end man in the minstrel show, the stupid one who was the butt of all the jokes, was Sambo. The paintings that adorned Sambo's pancake house were a retelling of the hugely popular children's book Little Black Sambo, written by Helen Bannerman, a Scottish woman living in India. It was published in America in 1900. According to author Phyllis J. Yule, author of Little Black Sambo, A Closer Look, Little Black Sambo describes a dark-skinned child's adventures with four tigers, wearing his new set of brightly colored clothes and carrying an umbrella for a walk in the jungle. Sambo finds that he must give each piece of beloved finery to the tigers to keep from being eaten. Jealous over their new possessions and increasingly enraged, the tigers discard the clothing and chase each other around the tree so ferociously that they turn to melted butter. While Sambo retrieves his garments, the butter is salvaged by Sambo's father, Black Jumbo, and is used to cook pancakes by Sambo's mother, Black Mumbo. They are so delicious that Mumbo has 27, Jumbo consumes 45, and Hungry Sambo devours 169. The book became a runaway hit, its illustrations becoming more caricatured and offensive with each reprinting. Sambo was often portrayed as a pickaninny, and Black Mumbo as an Aunt Jemima. Oh God, I remember her syrup. It was corn syrup. It was deadly. Food pyramid, Norman Borlaug reset. Oh yeah. Nominally set in India, the story was often reset in Africa or the American South. It appeared on almost every popular children's reading list for both white and black children through the 1940s, despite the harmful effects it had on children of all races. As one man in Nebraska recounted in the 1960s, "I sat through Little Black Sambo, and since I was the only black face in the room, I became a Little Black Sambo. If my parents had taught me bad names to call the little cracker kids, and I used that term on purpose to try to get a message across to you, You don't like it. Well, how do you think we feel when an adult is going to take our child and that adult gives these little white kids bad names to call him? Beginning in the late 1930s, some educators began voicing objections to the book being used in classrooms. But all this did not stop Sambo's Restaurant's meteoric rise, helped along by a unique system called Fraction of the Action, which gave location managers a stake in their restaurant's profits. Sambo's began to spring up all over the West. By 1965, there were 40 Sambo's pancake houses, serving both Sambo cakes and tiger butter. At the height of the civil rights movement, the chain embraced its association with Bannerman's story. Handmade murals by Colonel and Mrs. Hilmer Nelson illustrating the tale were part of the decor in every new location. And that wasn't all, according to Charles Bernstein. Sambo's theme was carried through with the tale of Sambo and the tiger stressed in the interior decor and on the menus. Sambo and tiger dolls were sold at each restaurant's cashier stands, and every child was given a Sambo's mask upon leaving the restaurant. While Sambo's would claim that its name was derived strictly from a combination of the two founders' names, it nevertheless capitalized on the Sambo story. By 1969, it was said that Sambo's was serving enough coffee each day to float a 45-foot yacht. Sambo's restaurants were opening all over the country at a dramatic pace. The chain added 125 new restaurants in 1975 alone. And at its peak, Sambo's would have 1,117 locations in 47 states. But civil rights leaders and town councils began to object to the restaurant, with the racially charged name appearing in their town. In the late 1970s, protests and lawsuits challenging the Sambo's name were occurring in Virginia, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Ohio, and Michigan. The company responded remarkably in a remarkably tone-deaf fashion. "There's no ground for changing it," Sam Battistoni Jr. said in response to calls for a name change from the city of Reston, Virginia in 1977. "We've operated these family restaurants for 20 years on a 24-hour basis, and it's been Sambo's whole 20 years. The name has been accepted across the country." Bruce Adekunle, vice president and general counsel of Sambo's, agreed. "We are aware of what appears to be a sentiment of a small portion of the people of Reston," he said. "Our position is that we have 850 restaurants throughout the country, 845 of them under the name Sambo's, and the problems you can count on one hand." Problems, yeah. In 1978-79, the growing controversy coincided with the financial collapse of Sambo's due to managerial and structural problems. Remarkably, even Sambo's biographer, Bernstein, sounded an indignant note when describing the chain's self-inflicted woes at the time. Woe. As if it didn't have enough trouble, Sambo's name in New England and some Midwestern states were repeatedly challenged now by the NAACP, civil rights groups, and indignant consumers. Suddenly, people were saying that Sambo's, once hailed as a great name, was a poor choice. Groups decided they didn't like the connotation of the name from the children's story, Little Black Sambo. Never mind that Sambo's hired a much higher percentage of blacks than most other companies and restaurant firms. Never mind that the name was derived from a combination of the two founders' name, Sam Sr. and Bonnet. Sambo's was automatically guilty of discrimination in the minds of many under the thinking of that era. While judges generally sided with Sambo's under the banner of the First Amendment, the damage in the court of public opinion was done. As one judge said, those who had problems with the chain's name could erect signs, carry placards, or publish advertisements designed to persuade others to refuse to patronize. That is what freedom of speech is all about. And so they did. Sambo's finally realized the seriousness of the issue, and attempted to start an education process to convince consumers Sambo's is anything but racist. They also changed the name of some restaurants in the Northeast and Midwest to No Place Like Sam's and Jolly Tiger. But this did little to rehabilitate their tarnished image. However, it was not protests against the name, but financial woes due to the company's restructuring and of the wildly popular Fraction of the Action scheme, which led to Sambo's filing for bankruptcy in 1981. That year, 450 Sambo's locations had either been sold or shuttered, except the original beachside Sambo's in Santa Barbara. You can still eat at Sambo's in Santa Barbara, right there on the sparkling beach. Amazingly, you can also still see the seven original paintings, which depict Sambo as a kind of cartoon baby genie. Battistoni heir Chad Stevens, who now runs the restaurant, told reporter Andrew Romano in 2014, We do get the occasional complaint. They want us to know the controversy of the name. And yet, for every complaint, there are about 1,000 people who say, wow, I can't believe it's still here, or open another one in our town. Today, the banner headline of Sambo's website reads, Doing It Right Since 1957. There you go. Dan, what are you doing? What are you doing here? Well, what am I doing here? Oh, if you follow my blog or listen to my podcasts, or if you've read my now world famous 20th edition manifesto, you surely know by now that I am in fact the most racist man in world history. But why? When I was a kid, we would go to a restaurant called Sambo's in Mount Vernon, Washington. It was like Denny's. It had the typical Americana fare of that late 20th century. All those special food types. Want some pancakes? Want some eggs and bacon? Want a nice patty melt? Why the fuck not? Go to Sambo's. Want to go to a restaurant with weird depictions of what appeared to be exploitation of a brown-skinned little boy? They got you, pal, at Sambo's. Kind of off topic, but when I was a kid, our parents would threaten us. If we were bad, listen, kids, if you don't quiet down, we're going to sell you to the Indians. That's right. My dad actually grew up on the res. He was a kid on the reservation. He had friends that were Native American, but growing up, when we kids got rowdy, you know, all of us, all eight of us, the parents would say, if you guys don't stop, they wouldn't threaten the gypsy thing, I suppose. They got that message from the State of Israel. But they would tell us, if you don't quiet down, if you don't behave, we're going to sell you to the Indians. Understand that the exploitation of Native Americans didn't stop in the year 1900. And one could argue it still hasn't stopped. At the time, I was being told that if we don't behave, we're going to sell you to the Native Americans. Native American kids were being forced to go to schools where they were being abused, and in many cases simply killed. And their bodies were being dumped, and nobody seemed to fucking care. And to this day, as far as populations go, the indigenous folks of North America are some of the most exploited. And some of the most forgotten. And in reality, the story my parents were telling me, you could easily reverse and it would be kind of true. If you kids don't behave, if you kids don't stop acting nice, I'm going to sell you to the white man. He'll take you to the Catholic school. That was racist, right? And you know, it was projection. A lot of it is projection. If you want to do a kind of research project. Research the literature of the mid-19th century, specifically the little short stories that would get published in Eastern magazines and newspapers and whatnot. Stories about the Wild West. Stories about the jungles and the forests and the craziness of that place, that uncivilized place out west. And whenever you came across a story involving Native Americans, what you'll notice, and it's not very complicated and not very subtle, is that they are painted in terrible ways because they're rapists and they're killers, and they go to your town and they burn it and they kill and they rape your daughters and whatnot. But when you really understand it and you think on it, that was projection too. That was basically a lot of folks, you know, being told what in fact we were doing. We were doing all those things. We were raping and killing. We were wholesale stealing. We were causing mayhem. We were doing what we needed to do to build the West, to build the railroads, to make sure the land gets tilled, you know, for the soil, for the crops. We were making sure that the frontier would be for the right kind of white kind of people. But the stories we told were of the savage who would steal your shit, who would break agreements, who would lie and kill. Nice projection. I don't know. The other little scare monkey, you know, for where I grew up, the other scare monkey, and I'm not making this up, it was something that, you know, I think my siblings would talk about, I think my sisters mainly, was the black man. The black man. It might be obvious to you, but I grew up in a place that was not mixed. We had black people in Mount Vernon, Washington in the 1970s and 80s, but there weren't really very many. And since there were so few, I even think real racists at the time just kind of left them alone. You know, it's from watching Little House on the Prairie, right? What would Michael Landon do? I mean Charles Ingalls, right? But my sisters, they would tell that story. And we would tell it to each other, I guess. We would say if something, you know, if you're not, it's not so much if you're not good. If you do something, if you do something, whatever something is X, the black man is coming for you. And it is just like the boogeyman. It's a conjuring. You're conjuring the black man. Go to the mirror and say black man 12 times and the black man will come out of the shed, because that's where the black man comes from, the shed. How did we learn this? From things that we picked up, you know? It's kind of shallow, in my opinion, and broken to say that the book, Little Black Sambo, was just a book. It's very empty. I am a radical supporter of free speech, but I'm a radical supporter of free speech because if you read that article, at one point the author points out, public opinion destroyed Sambos. Yeah, they had that crazy piece of the action, which leads me to believe that Sam Battistoni is not his real, well, was not, you know, he's dead by now, but wasn't his real name. And I kind of think maybe he was in the witness protection program. Like he might have been one of those first good fellas that got moved, you know what I'm saying? Because that fraction of the action, that sounds like some real Jersey bullshit. The black man is coming. And he's going to have sex with you. He's going to give you a baby. That's what the sisters would say to each other. The black man is coming. And he's going to steal your bike and beat you up. They would threaten me and my brother with that story as well. It was terrible. It was constructed. It was bullshit. It was fear. Fear of something that didn't exist. Not in Mount Vernon, Washington in the 1970s and 80s. But it was a fear that we got fed. And we consumed it. And it became part of us, even if we claim it didn't. And then there's the N-word. People will have incomprehensibly silly conversations about what MK Ultra was or is. But I gotta say, try to get some random ex-gen white guy to say the N-word in public, or even in private. I try to say it, I go, nah. And immediately I see that fuck from Reading Rainbow. I go, nah, and he's tied to a pole. He's being whipped by some random white guy, probably your dad. And he's being whipped and beaten. And he says repeatedly, I am not Kunta Kente. I am not Kunta Kente. My name is LeVar Burton. And he looks at you with those saucer eyes, all pasted over with tears. But the torturer cares not for his lament. He is paid, the torturer, in tears and blood. That's what he is waiting for, bud. And so LeVar Burton is beaten. Every time I try to say the N-word, I immediately see LeVar Burton from Reading Rainbow tied to a pole being beaten to death, and then he looks at me and I can't say it. I try to. I mutter it. I go, nah, and then I see him. It's the prima facie truth, baby, that MK Ultra, it worked. They did, in fact, you know, impact our brains when we were growing up. Who knows how? It could have simply been cultural programming, but for all intents and purposes, every time you want to say that word, you see little Carrie from Little House stuck down the well or in a cave. Boy, she got abused and exploited for a dramatic pitch, that Carrie from Little House on the Prairie. She'd be down a well or she'd get kidnapped. Oh, we can't come up with ideas for a show this week. Why don't we toss Carrie down a well again? Or maybe Bandit has to die. Oh God, the dog has to die. Oh boy. Poor Laura Ingalls. Every time I try to say that terrible fucking word, I go, nah, and I can't say it. And I know that I'm a monster for even wanting to say it. You know, if I could say it, should I say it? Should I? Unlock the final hatch and catch a ray of hope by muttering that dark term, I don't know. Can I, should I, will I? Tune in and see. Reach every good goy in November for you and me. Reg gin is regular gin. It's all I'm talking about, baby, and I see LeVar Burton again. I can't say it, it reminds me of Sambo's. Gin, red gin, gin, red gin. I'm Irish, I'm a drunk. Red gin, ginger, think about it. I guess all of this leads to the essential truth that I am the most racist person in world history. This also relates back to the case that I am actually really Hitler. And here we are. The most racist man in history has a brain condition, probably induced as a result of exposure to population-wide mind control experiments, you know, as part of MK Ultra. It kind of sucks. But I'm okay. I love you. I'm okay. I love you. Here's a quote from Dr. Freckles. I don't know enough, but I know enough to be dangerous. I don't know enough, I can't know enough, but I do know enough to be dangerous. I think that describes a lot of us, you know, and maybe it's one of those features of the human condition. You know, I don't know. Maybe this gets back to that whole Socratic, the greatest wisdom is to know you know nothing. Maybe it is related to the whole holy fuck, the general epistemological condition bullshit, the metaphysics of isolation within consciousness, the reality that you're just a puff of fat in a bone cave floating around. You have a cable connection to the outside. You have connections to your eyes, your ears, your nose, your toes. But at the end of the day, you are just sitting in a chunk of fat in a dark bone cave, you know, floating in water. We don't know enough. We never will. We're born, we know nothing. I mean, if you believe in previous past lives bullshit, you could say, well, no, Dan, I was born with it. I know you were Elvis. So many people were Elvis. Have I ever told you the story of the true cross, the pieces of the true cross that were on display in cathedrals across Europe in the 12th and 13th centuries? So many cathedrals had pieces of the true cross, the cross that Jesus was crucified on. If you collected up all these pieces of the true cross, you could probably build a fleet of ships. I don't know enough, but I know enough to be dangerous, Dr. Freckles. Here's another Dr. Freckles quote. All manifestos are fiction. Let's just rip that Band-Aid off. The Communist Manifesto is fiction. My Danifesto is technically fiction. If you read a manifesto, you're reading fiction. If you read Mein Kampf, you're reading fiction. If you read Mao's Little Red Book, you're reading fiction. It's funny, though, because when I thought to myself a few weeks ago that the one thing that was missing from my life was publishing a manifesto, because you really can't do something big, and that's all I can say on the podcast, you can't astound people with great events and acts of crazy unless you have a manifesto. Then you do whatever the fuck you want. That's what you do next. You get into woodworking. You get yourself a shed in Montana. You get yourself a nice, you know, account at the USPS so it's easy to send stuff out, you know. Maybe a FedEx speed account. Because you're woodworking. You're making little things out of country-style wood. Manifestos are bullshit, brothers and sisters. My Danifesto, even if you enjoy it and you decide to like print off copies and sell it, it's bullshit. It's writing. Some of it might be good. It doesn't really matter. But if you think that manifestos are the way to go, like that's the way forward, no. No, it's a red flag, really. Here's another quote from Dr. Freckles. Some of the answers is enough, hopefully. Yeah, that kind of relates to that other quote, the thing about knowing enough to be dangerous. This is related. Some of the answers is enough, hopefully. Well, Dr. Freckles, sometimes some of the answers is not nearly enough. Sometimes just a piece of the puzzle is just a piece of the puzzle. Sometimes you have to accept that maybe you don't know enough to know anything about what's going on. Like maybe the sources of information you have are crap. That maybe Qbert was right. Everything you know is wrong. I don't want to doom people to a condition where they have no way out, but I didn't do the dooming. It's sort of like the recent events that I want to just sort of let blink into the past again because I don't like the wound being opened. But if you've been listening to my podcast the last couple of days, you know that I got an email from a quote-unquote journalist. And the journalist's angle is, you know, these conspiracy theorists, alt-right people, got Trump elected, blah, blah, blah. Clearly, if she spent any time researching my website, she decided to not call me. Because as bad as her targets were, she probably realized, I'm way worse. I'm really bad. One of the things I tell people is you should be curious enough to do your own research. That's not right. You're not supposed to say that. That's racist. Some of the answers is enough, hopefully, but it probably isn't. Next topic. Here's another quote from Dr. Freckles. Oh boy, Dan, and then we're done. Another quote from Dr. Freckles. Nietzsche was to ethics and psychology what Einstein was to physics and bagels. Nietzsche was to ethics what Einstein was to physics. Nietzsche was to psychology what Einstein was to bagels. Bagels. Nietzsche was to ethics and psychology what Einstein was to physics. What does that mean, Dr. Well, there's not much here, but what you should get from the whole let's take this apart is that I think psychology is as relevant to your life and useful as bagels. So there you go. Dan, you're mean. You just said psychology is like a new kind of bagel, and yeah, pretty much. It's a soft science, but really it's very limp. You know, it probably needs to go on the T, but it's not going to. It will stay limp and flaccid. Yeah, Nietzsche was to ethics and psychology what Einstein was to physics and bagels. If you like my podcast, I have no earthly idea why, but if you do, you can donate to it. There's a link to PayPal. Everybody could use money these days, but before you click on that link, that Peter Thiel blood link, understand a few things. I cannot take delivery of stuff by mail. It's way too late in the game to assume that's a way to send stuff to me or people like me. My mail gets opened. It's not because I'm special, it's because I'm on the same secret list that you are, dipshit, so don't send me shit through the mail. The only way you can donate is through the link. If you don't like Peter Thiel, I don't give a fuck. It's the only way you can donate. Before you donate, understand, I am not a 501c3, and if somebody offered that to me, I would tell them to fuck off. So this is not tax-deductible shithead. Take care of your food, water, shelter first. Before you donate money to random people on the internet, make sure you got your rent paid. Make sure you've purchased the food. Make sure that your situation is safe. If there are people in your immediate life that need help, help them first before you donate to me or anybody else's podcast. If you're setting aside food because you think a famine is coming, and yeah, Rome starves last, A, and B, a famine is coming, in my opinion. If you're setting aside food 6 months worth because, hey, you're an optimist, and you have a dog, a cat, a rat, or a bat, well, make sure you're setting aside food for them too, unless you intend to eat them. And understand, it's not the end of the world. A lot of people are fear-mongering that shit right now. It's not helpful. Are we in really strange times? Yes. Could there be some catastrophic, fucking crazy-ass shit ahead of us? Yeah, there could be. Does that mean it's the end of the world? No. No, the only thing that's probably going to end is endism. The only thing that's going to be shuttered is the belief that history had a stop sign. History never stopped. we wanted to play pretend in the 1990s that somehow we'd reached a special point. And so, you know, Francis Fukuyama Fukuyama and his bullshit was plastered all over the liberal arts anal cavity getaways in the late 80s and 90s to tell us, well, the great liberal democracies have succeeded, and no longer is there strife. And for the rest of your life, history never ended. The lie, the bullshit, is that it did. But it also doesn't mean it's the end of the world. Right now, there are things you can still do. In a few months, perhaps a year, but I think sooner, a lot of things are going to be more difficult. The time is coming when going 20 miles will be harder than going 2,000 miles today. Sorry. But stuff works right now. You can still load up your car and go on a drive. It's going to be expensive, but you can do it. You can still go to the grocery store and make yourself a nice meal. It's going to be what it is, but you can do it. You can take a friend to a restaurant. You can do these things. You can give yourself a break because shit is crazy. And yeah, if you need someone to give you permission to take a break from the crazy, well, your good friend Dan just did. So do that before you donate money to my fucking podcast. But if you've done all these things and you're Bitcoin rich and your bitch lover is covered in diamonds and sweat, I bet you have a mountain of gold, pal, and you sit upon it like old Al Greenstein from the old times, you know, when we used to hang out, you know, in London, when you sold me the curtain fries and the old man dies and we had to bury the bottom. The body, we had to bury the body at the bottom of Loch Ness. And the great worm came out of the sea and looked at us, looked at you, looked at me, and told us the time is coming, baby. Get ready. You can donate as much as you want, buddy. You can give me all of your gold. I will travel to Loch Ness. I will sign a peace treaty with the monster. It is Saturday, November the 23rd. It's almost 9 p.m. here on the Olympic Peninsula. People going downtown to go crazy party because Port Angeles is hopping. There's all kinds of raves and kids with glow sticks. Oh, yeah. They're going downtown to get excited. Everybody's going to party and be excited because everything's so fucking great. People are so happy that Papa Blump is now in charge. Let's see what happens with that. All I know is I'm being lied to. All I know is that even knowing that you're being lied to doesn't really matter. Have a great evening.